You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, a tribal historic preservation officer for the St. Croix Chippewa of Wisconsin joins us with an invitation to hear the stories of our land and its First Nations. Now, five police officers in Memphis were charged with second-degree murder last week after they were captured on video beating 29-year-old Tyree Nichols, who died 3 days later. Today, another officer was suspended from duty. The beating occurred after a traffic stop for erratic driving, something the Memphis Police Department says it has yet to confirm. Nichols, a photographer and father, fled officers but was unarmed and did not show signs of fighting back. The incident led to peaceful protests in Memphis as well as other cities over the weekend. Lawmakers in Tennessee and at the federal level have already called for more reforms in police training and use of force policies. And we're talking now about what all this can tell us about policing in America today. And we invite you to join us. What was your reaction to the death of Tyree Nichols? Did you see the video? What do you think can be done to make policing better and incidents like this less common? 1-800-642-1234. Do you hope to see officers be held accountable more often? And if you work in law enforcement, show us what you see through your eyes. 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas at WPR.org. Khalil Gibran Muhammad is a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He directs the Institutional Anti-Racism and Accountability Project. He's co-host of the podcast Some of My Best Friends Are and is author of the book The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Khalil, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Would like to get your reaction of what you saw on Friday and what you're left feeling with today.
Well, I saw the disturbing execution of a man who, by any reasonable determination, did nothing, absolutely nothing, to deserve to die. And while this one incident has yet again forced a national conversation about state violence or police brutality and police murder in particular, we simply don't know how many other Tyree Nichols go unscathed in the most lethal sense of the term after having endured some form of brutalization, because we don't keep track of such things, which is a big problem. But we do know that more people have died this year, according to informal tracking methods, than have died over the last several years by the hands of police. So we're moving in the wrong direction.
After other officer-involved killings in recent years, a good deal of the media attention has been about race, often about a white officer attacking a person of color. In this case, all five officers are Black. Is this a time to start thinking about how the institution of policing is bigger than just the race of the officers, Khalil?
It's always been that case. While most Americans are taught at some point or socialized or hear in a news story to think of these incidents as the consequence of individual officers, of rotten apples, it is the institution itself of policing that for most of history and most especially in the last 100 years has more keenly focused its resources on Black and brown low-income communities than any other. And of course, listeners will say, but that's where the crime is. That is true to a degree. What is not true is just because there is crime there doesn't mean that we get this kind of policing. So the issue here is that institutional racism has given license to the kind of daily brutalities that have been reported on, have been cited in Department of Justice investigations, all the way up to the most lethal incidences of unarmed, innocent people. I mean, let's just lean into it. I mean, Tyree Nichols had not been adjudicated in court for having broken a crime, let alone accused of anything more than a potential traffic violation. So this is the issue. Institutional racism is part of a longer history and context in which Black people get a certain kind of policing, no matter who the police officers are, whether they are Black or white. The man, when Derek Chauvin was had his knee on the neck of George Floyd, two other men of color were there by his side. When people were killed on the Danziger Bridge in 2005 in the midst of the Hurricane Katrina disaster, people were shot in the back by police officers. One of them charged with murder in that case was a black man along with white officers. In the case of the killing of Freddie Gray, six officers were accused of being responsible for his death, which was part of a process of putting him unsecure in the back of a police van. Three of those officers who were ultimately acquitted in that case were black. So we've been having a conversation that also includes the behavior of black officers.
Do you take any heart in the rather comparatively quick accountability of seeing criminal charges against these five police officers from Memphis?
Absolutely. I think that had this been the history alongside the one I just told, this might have ended a generation ago. But for the most part, what happened in the case of these five, and to be clear, black officers, is exceptional.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, our guest, professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, taking your questions as well today at 1-800-642-1234, where Tina in Lake Geneva is standing by. Tina, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I am the mother of a biracial child who's half black. So watching the video and him crying out 800 yards from his mother's home, crying for his mother, was probably one of the most disturbing things I've seen. It's heartbreaking, and we should all be concerned about this matter. But as a mental health professional, I want to hear more discussions about the emotional dysregulation of every one of those police officers on the video. Even if this young man was driving in an incorrect manner, the way that you respond to him, you're required to have emotional regulation, which means you do not go to the door and say, why the F are you effing this, and I'm going to drag you out of the effing car. It should have been calm. This man never brandished a weapon. And I just want to see more done for mental health concerns for law enforcement beyond racism.
Tina, thank you for your perspective as well as your question when it comes to what can be done. Better police training. I mean, a lot of the video that I saw on Friday was after the beating was police, you know, not attending 7 minutes of emergency personnel, not attending to Tyree after the beating. And a certain sense of detachment from the police officers appeared clear, Khalil.
No, I think that's that is telling us that there's more going on in the culture of emergency response in addition to policing. There is a level of deference to the scene of a police stop where everyone essentially immediately falls in line that some horrible person has been captured. Someone akin to a domestic terrorist that we must all stand back and engage in the least productive manner. I want to add something to what Tina said, because there is ongoing research at the Center for Policing Equity, work being done to look particularly at the screening processes of police departments around the country, because we already have good evidence that policing attracts a certain kind of warrior mentality on top of people who are recruited for their military experience. And certain people's personality profiles show up aside from whether they have strong anti-Black bias or anti-Brown bias, are much more likely to engage in violence, are much more likely to be short-tempered. The problem here is probably within that context, yes, but even worse, because this was a street crimes unit that was essentially designed to be people who would be aggressive. Mm-hmm. And the question is, why would a street crimes unit generally deploy to look for guns or drug dealing or to get violent people off the street be so aggressive over a motor violation, other than the fact that it was a pretext stop, which means that if you have a young black man driving in a car and have a reason to pull that person over, that's good enough. And that's what makes this fundamentally about structural racism.
Back to your calls with our guest, Khalil Gibran Muhammad, now at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Marlon in Madison. Good afternoon, Marlon.
Hello. This is Marlon Banks.
Hi, Marlon.
Hi. I was just leaving a comment saying that I don't really think anything is going to change unless we have some type of national forum. Otherwise, it's just going to continue like some type of mathematical constant in an equation. You have to have a different variable that's going to make a difference. And I don't think, just like in this case where they address the issue of crime or violence in particular neighborhoods by putting more African-Americans on particular scorpion forces like this one, that's not going to do it. And I'm recalling back to, I'm a retired school teacher now. I was a special education teacher for the district here in Madison. And our diversity training days were the quietest day of the school year. I think partly that was because, like in my case, I was the only African-American teacher in the building. And so everyone was afraid of saying something that might sound racist, so they would say nothing. And then they always expected me to speak first, right? So, and then there were people who were afraid of offending me by saying something that might be misconstrued as racist. Well, that's what I mean. There has to be a different variable. It can't just be black people speaking about issues of race.
I thank you, Marlon, and it can't just be black people speaking about issues of race, Khalil. There has to be a different variable, Marlon says, and what would that variable be?
Well, I think we are probably reaching the limits of so-called training to solve for this problem. The movement to do really fundamental criminal justice reform and policing reform was upended over the past year and a half, even in places like Minneapolis, New York City. A lot of municipalities and cities turned away from some of the boldest suggestions that came forth after the killing of George Floyd. And the truth is that what we've replaced those proposals with is more funding for police officers in the form of more training. So we have to come to terms with the fact that policing, by definition, is a limited tool to address a range of social problems that exist in our society. And until we develop our capacity to find the right tools, not, I shouldn't say that, to deploy the correct tools to solve for the right problems, then we're going to have this problem. We have systems that are not perfect, and they also have anti-Black bias and structural racism baked into them, but they are far less lethal, and they have the capacity to improve dramatically outcomes where people actually can get the help that they deserve. Some examples right now, and I'll stop with this quick example, is some municipalities such as Ithaca, New York, have simply stopped using the police to do low-level traffic enforcement. So, of course, what happened to Tyree Nichols would not have happened in the first place because officers would not have pulled over someone over something that appeared to be minor. What they would have done is taken his license plate and sent him a ticket for a traffic violation.
We're talking with Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard University. And we're looking at the death of Tyree Nichols at the hands of Memphis police officers and what it tells us about policing and what can change. And you can join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard. He's also the author of the book, The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America, taking a look at the murder of Tyree Nichols in Memphis, with five city police officers being charged with second-degree homicide last week, and taking your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234, where Martha and Rhineland are standing by. Martha, good afternoon.
Hi. I just have an observation, I guess. My mother and I both had several uncles and policemen that were several uncles and cousins who were policemen in the city of Chicago. Some were in the seedier parts of Chicago, which is in every city. Some were Michigan Avenue and Lincoln Park, which is very ritzy areas. I've never my uncle spent 30 years in the field, and he was so jaded by the time he retired. It was awful. His son retired after 30 years, having been in a nicer neighborhood. And I know I'm you know, singling out nice neighborhoods and seedy neighborhoods. But is there any thought ever to anyone revamping the police in terms of, you know, 10 years in the field, 10 years on the desk, 10 years training other policemen. I mean, 30 people can't be 30 years in the field. I know these policemen that killed Tyree Nichols were all on the medium to younger side, but you can't be expected to see some of the things policemen see and retain your humanity. I just think 30 years in the field is too much. And, you know, I think they have to screen better for people who are, you know, more racist, more narrow-minded, and basically cruel. But the 10-10-10 idea, I think, is a long time coming and should be looked at.
Well, let's ask our guest, Khalil. Where do you think the focus should be for policy changes? Should it sound like something Martha's offering?
Well, I think Martha's spot on, and I appreciate her sharing her family's experience. She's spot on in, again, bringing our attention to better screening of people who are selected for law enforcement in the first place. One of the things that the federal legislation that did not pass in the wake of the George Floyd killing, the George Floyd and Policing Act, called for essentially making the history of officers available to the federal government as a registry so that people wouldn't be shifted and moved around from one police agency to another if they had a history of brutality or of high levels of complaints against them. So Martha's right about we can do far better in terms of screening out and tracking people who have a history of abuse. I have not heard the 10-10-10 plan, but it sounds very compelling. And I think it's worth, you know, throwing all the really possible ideas for change on the board. So I'm just going to affirm for Martha that that she may be onto something.
Martha, thank you for the call. And Khalil, I want to ask you, like, we've seen the numbers, the statistics. Milwaukee's just one of the many major cities that saw a rise in homicides over the last few years. And how do you think those cities can balance public safety with not over-policing or using tactics that feel like they're attacking communities that they're charged to keeping safe?
Well, there's two roads that we should be traveling at this point. First of all, we talk about, and this is context for the answer, we talk about the resurgence of violent crime as if we live in a historical vacuum. We've been down this road before. The difference is that what happened in the mid-1980s and the early 90s that led to both the high rates of violence and massive incarceration of people is that we can't really build a system any bigger or more punitive than we already have. That should tell us that that tool of punitive responses from policing to incarceration is not going to be the best approach going forward. If we were to see the return of levels of violence that we saw 25 years ago, I can't even imagine what kind of police state that most of us would be witness to and live in if we try to outdo what we've already done. What we can do is we can take 20 years of evidence-based and proven approaches of community violence interruption, which comes in many different forms, but one form in particular is to work with people who already are in the community, who are credible messengers, sometimes as formerly incarcerated people, who can work to prevent conflict from escalating. This is called cure violence in some places. It's called ceasefire in other places, and in other places it goes by a different name. We are underfunding a tool that we already have at our disposal to address community violence. It is less lethal, it is far more effective, and it will free police officers to do things that they do well, which is, in this case, to respond to calls for service. In these cases, they're not even necessarily calls for service because community violence interrupters are already in the community. They know where the retaliation is going to occur. They know who's more likely to engage in carjacking or other forms of violence that are terrorizing to people who live in those communities.
And just to be clear here, you talked earlier, Khalil, about this range of societal problems or social problems that exist in society, and we ask the police to deal with them all. Is it unfair of us to be asking the police to continue to expand the things that they are charged with controlling, keeping, being in charge of it all?
That's absolutely. And police officers will tell you this themselves. I just served on a 2-year consensus study by the National Academies of Sciences. We talked to several police officers before issuing our report, and people are free to download the report at the National Academy of Sciences. The report is free to download. And what we know is that police officers don't want to be called to deal with someone locked out of their home, to deal with the cat in the tree, to deal with the misbehaving child who's not listening to their parents. And yet, in most cases, municipalities expect their officers to at least show some goodwill towards those calls. So we, as citizens of these communities, are contributing to the problem ourselves, and certainly not offering the kind of support that leaders and municipal leaders need to redirect or to create new resources that would be more suited for most of the calls for service. Most people don't realize that only about 5% of arrest activity in this country is related to violent offenses. The vast majority of things that police officers are called for have nothing to do with violence.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, if we were to make one change that would make a difference in a way where we would not see stories like these come up again in the way that they've come up in the past, what would it be?
I think because this is a very decentralized problem, we have 18,000 versions of a law enforcement agency. I honestly think that dealing with the collective bargaining agreements that limit what happened in Memphis in too many instances, that is swift termination and the filing of legal charges that stick, which has to do with qualified immunity as well. If we can make the possibility that those collective bargaining agreements would no longer protect officers from their own abusive and criminal behavior when it rises to that, we can go a long way to changing the incentive structures that allow people to sometimes get away with murder.
Hey, Khalil, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard. Also the author of the book, The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. He's also the co-host of the podcast, Some of My Best Friends Are, with one of his best friends. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, how Wisconsin fits into Amtrak's broader vision for passenger rail connecting the Midwest to everywhere else. Kate Archer Kent meets with the Amtrak's new director of network development for the Central Region. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, we get to the bassy brass tacks of a Wisconsin question from a listener about the humble tuna, tuba, and the instrument's place in Wisconsinites' hearts. Now, winter time is traditionally story time for the Ojibwe people and the land we now call Wisconsin. And the Wisconsin Historical Society has been hosting a series of online events throughout January featuring Ojibwe storytellers from around the state. The final online forum will be tomorrow night at 7 with our next guest, and you can find the details under the related links section of our website at wpr.org/centraltime. Wanda McFagan is a tribal historic preservation officer for the St. Croix Chippewa of Wisconsin. And Wanda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me why these stories, like the ones you'll be sharing tomorrow night, why these stories are important.
Well, they fill our time during winter, but they're also teaching stories and hold some morale and some values in there. And that's traditionally how we taught our children, is to talk with them.
And how did you first come about some of these stories, Wanda?
Well, I've been in preservation for 22 years. So at different gatherings, I've heard stories. A lot of Native people will refer that they were taught by their grandmothers, but I didn't know my grandmother. I was raised in the city, so I didn't have a strong connection to the traditions and the values. So I had to learn and kind of become like a sponge for knowledge. So, and I've just picked up different things along the way working in my position.
And without sharing the full story, one of those tales you'll be telling tomorrow night would be about the Ojibwe dream catchers. Can you explain a little bit about why they look different than the kind you'd normally think of or you'd commonly find in a store?
Well, that was a gift from this, what we call in English, she would be known as Spider Lady. She brought us that gift when it became hard for her to make it to all of the babies in the nation here. So she gifted us with that. Ours looks different from, I guess you would call maybe the Lakota version, mm-hmm. what you see in stores and the common dream catcher that you see. Ours looks like a spider web that you would see if you go outside in the summertime. You see the spider web in the tree. Ours looks very similar to that. Hmm. And the background is basically the same, you know, that it releases the good dreams and holds on to the bad dreams or something like that. I'm not sure if I'm getting that correct or not.
Wanda McVagan is a tribal historic preservation officer for the St. Croix Chippewa of Wisconsin, and she'll be presenting tomorrow evening through the Wisconsin Historical Society stories of the series of the Ojibwe storytellers, and you can find the link at WPR.org/Central Time. And Wanda, what are you hoping people take away from the stories that you share tomorrow night?
Just a little bit of thought, maybe some seeds for our people to think about, you know, and some of them are teachings, so they may get something out of them, at least I'm hoping. And just education. Education is very important to us.
Planting some seeds and hope that come spring they may grow.
Yep, I'm hoping.
Hey, Wanda, I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Lee, and it was nice talking with you.
Pleasure's mine. Wanda McVagan, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the St. Croix Chippewa of Wisconsin. And you can hear more of her stories tomorrow night in a free online forum hosted by Wisconsin's Historical Society. And again, you can find the related link on our website at WPR.org/Central Time. But now it's time for Wisconsin Life. And here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an upcoming Western Wisconsin ski jump tournament.
Volunteers are busy in Westby, Wisconsin, getting ready for the Snowflake Ski Club's annual tournament. As WPR's Ezra Wall tells us, this year is extra special since the club is celebrating its 100th year.
It's a windy night in Westby as volunteers with the Snowflake Ski Club groom the hills below the 5 and 10 meter ski jumps. The temperature is mild by Wisconsin winter standards, and about a dozen elementary school-age kids are getting ready for practice.
I can't get them! It's too slippery!
For 100 years, nestled in the steep hills of the Driftless area, this club has taught generations of athletes. Members have also hosted ski jumpers from around the world for its annual tournament. Just across County P from the ski jump is Snowflake's clubhouse. That's where I met Dan Ellefson. The Westby native learned to jump on the club's smaller hills as a kid before braving the big jump, which measures over 100 meters.
I was 20, I think, the first time I skied the big hill. Most guys get there before that. The holy smokes am I high. It was fun. I got to the bottom of the hill, and I thought I made it, and I fell backwards, and I got up, and I said, I can't wait to get back up there. You're probably in the air 3 to 4 seconds, but when you're flying through the air and just watching the ground go by underneath you, it feels like a long time. Time goes pretty slow.
Back across the county road at the smaller jumps, coaches are working with kids from 5 to about 10 years old.
Butt lower. So I want to see that all the way down until you're ready to jump.
So you want me that low?
I want you low, and if you think you're low, go lower.
Janine Morley's whole household is a Snowflake family. Her husband is a volunteer, and her oldest daughter, Mackenzie, is this year's Snowflake Queen. Tonight, Janine is here to watch and help coach her 9-year-old daughter, Maddie.
Definitely balance, their in run, you know, the proper form, that type of thing is super important. You know, to, you know, the form more so, you know, they really want that form, not so much, you know, like these littles, how far they can jump, but just being able to get down and be in that in run when they go down to land. And yeah, so you can really see a difference in the kids when they have the correct form, you know.
Snowflake's most prominent local export was Lyle Swenson, who captained the American ski jumping team in the 1964 Olympics in Innsbruck, Austria. Morley says renewed energy around the club's youth program has folks hoping for an equally bright future, especially among the club's teen competitors.
You could tell there's definitely some that are really excelling here. Yeah, we've got some that are just amazing to watch already this year. And they've been traveling this year already. Eau Claire last weekend, Minneapolis, I believe they're going to be at this weekend with quite a few of these guys too.
Coach Derek Lundy is a third-generation Snowflake ski jumper. He's coaching his kids, the fourth generation of Lundys, to jump in Westby.
Certainly makes a proud dad to see him come down that jump, and I see a lot of similarities from just the style of the kids, how they jump, and then the style of what I would do when I was a kid, so it's kind of neat to see that.
But as much as he enjoys coaching, he still remembers what it was like soaring off the jumps in his competitive days.
You know, you're basically flying, and there's not a lot of things that in this world that can make you feel like you're flying in the air. So it's the rush of that, and, you know, once you do it once, it's pretty addicting.
Volunteers like Coach Derek Lundy are hoping this year's Snowflake Ski Jump Tournament helps propel the club into its next 100 years.
WPR's Ezra Wall brought us that story on the Snowflake Ski Club in Westby. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a listener became enthralled and then curious about tuba culture in Wisconsin after moving here. So she asked us about it, and we've got her answers next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn. And that is Sotto Voce, the quartet, with two euphoniums and two tubas, performing the song Power, written by John Stevens. Why? Well, we recently received a question from a listener, Elizabeth Renner from Madison, and she asked,
why are tubas such a prominent part of the UW-Madison band, and why are they so popular in the state of Wisconsin?
Great question, Elizabeth. John Stevens is a longtime tuba performer and composer. In 1985, he joined the faculty of the UW-Madison School of Music, where he led one of the most prestigious low brass studios in the country. He was the tubist with the Wisconsin Brass Quintet and served as the director of the School of Music for 7 years. He retired from the university in 2014 and is now professor emeritus. And he wrote the piece we were just listening to. And Mike Forbes is just one of John's former students at UW and a performer on that recording. He currently plays principal tuba with La Crosse, Beloit, Janesville, and Manitowoc Symphonies, and leads Wisconsin's premier large brass ensemble, the Isthmus Brass. He also teaches low brass at UW-La Crosse. Central Time producer Tim Peterson talked with them about Elizabeth's tuba questions.
So before we get to the Madison Marching Band, let's first talk about the popularity of tubas in Wisconsin. John, how did tubas get their start in the Badger State?
I think there's actually a lot of things that led to the popularity these days. The basic German culture of the state, I think, has a lot to do with it. Polka bands, bands and beer, if you will. The musical influences from the German culture have been a big part of that. Then there's also a strong Civil War band tradition in the state that I think all these years later still has sort of carried on. The Broadhead Brass Band, for example, was one of the more well-known bands in the Civil War era. And so that and the German culture and certainly what's happened here at UW-Madison with the popularity statewide of the marching band in particular, you know, people see the tubas and sousaphones all the time, and, you know, it's just that's now become part of the culture as well.
And Mike, you've been playing with symphonies around the state. You're currently playing. Could you talk a little bit more about the sort of statewide popularity at the local level?
Sure. There's something about the Midwest and bands in general that they're just much more proliferated around here than they are out east. For example, I'm originally from Pennsylvania, and we still have a strong Germanic culture there as well. But somehow the community bands aren't as present as they are in the Midwest. Every little town has its own unique community band or orchestra even. And in this case, I think a lot of the orchestras I play with kind of grew out of what was a community orchestra and then has become more of a professional orchestra. Say, for example, the one in La Crosse and Manitowoc. A lot of this tradition just started, I think, again, from what John was mentioning, that early immigrant idea of having every town having its own brewery, its own band, and its own culture in its little area. Because, you know, travel was difficult, of course, back in those days. Today, we don't even think about crossing the state in a heartbeat. But back in those days, with horse-drawn carriages, you got your entertainment in your local community.
And Mike, our question asker Elizabeth, who moved to Madison a year ago, says since coming here, she feels like everyone she knows someone who plays a tuba, or everyone's dad plays a tuba. Does that sound pretty accurate to you?
Absolutely. I teach actually about 20 students here in the Madison area in private lessons, and about half of those are kids whose dad played the tuba. So there is something to be said about that. Also, anytime I go out and do like a little clinic for kindergartners, I can't tell you, as soon as I come in the door, all these hands shoot up. It's, oh, my dad plays that. And then I said, oh, yeah, what's it called? And they say, it's a trumpet. And I'm like, no, it's a tuba. So there is some confusion sometimes.
Can we circle back to this polka music? How important is the tuba to polka?
I think the tuba is the largest, shiniest, most obvious visual instrument in any polka band. I think that actually has a lot to do with the popularity. I might make the analogy to, you know, the elephants at the zoo. I mean, it's an instrument that catches people's eye and their ear. Also, it's playing the bass line. It's playing something that is going on every second of every piece. Mm. You know, I mean, people sing the melodies, but I think there's also this, we all sort of feel this bass line when we're listening to a polka band or a rock band or any kind of band. And the association with the tuba or the sousaphone or both really resonates literally inside of people.
And Mike, you have brought a special guest to the studio, your tuba. Would you mind playing just a little example of this polka bass line?
Sure. I mean, it's just oscillating between sort of what, if you're any kind of a musician, the tonic and dominant for the most part. Something like that.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Mike. And we are talking with Mike Forbes, professional tuba player for multiple symphonies in Wisconsin and a low brass teacher at UW-La Crosse. We're also joined by John Stevens, a longtime tuba performer and composer and emeritus professor of music at UW-Madison. And we're answering a Wisconsin question about the popularity of tubas in Wisconsin and the prominence of that instrument in the UW-Madison marching band. And John, let's pivot to talking about that band. Again, our question asker Elizabeth was in awe seeing more than two dozen sousaphone players in UW's band compared with a much smaller number in her band when she was in high school. Why is this instrument such a prominent part of the Badger Band?
Well, this goes back quite a long way. The two most recent directors of the Badger Marching Band put together probably make up something pretty close to a century. Ray Dvorak and then Mike LaCrone have been, you know, at the helm of this group for a long, long time. And there have been various stages over the years of the way they used individual instrument sections. I think back in the 50s, the individual, like the trumpets or the trombones or the sousaphones would go into the stands and play and everything. And Mike LaCrone certainly took that tradition and made the most of it in terms of the sousaphone march thing that they do. And again, I think all the things that we've already been talking about contribute to this. They are front and center in the musical part of those football games every week. And, you know, when I first moved here in the 1980s, the UW football program was not especially at the high end of its competency. Mike actually put a lot of the current traditions into place back then, because that's when the whole marching band thing became so popular because, to be honest, for quite a few years there, it was the best thing that people saw and heard at the football game. And so people, when you see a number of sousaphone players walk into a stadium, it's a visual and visceral kind of thing in addition to the sound that you're hearing. So I think folks just... they just love to see it. You know, there's a little bit, the tuba or the sousaphone are kind of underdog instruments too. And, you know, around a lot of the country, the place where we live here in Wisconsin is often referred to as one of the flyover states. So there's a little bit of an underdog attitude perhaps about that too. I just think it's a natural, as Mike said before, here in the Midwest, the fit between the way people consider the tuba and where we live is a good one.
And Mike, you have taught players who have been in this band, and you've learned a little bit more about the section. What else can you tell us?
Well, I know that they affectionately call these sousaphones rhinos because of the gigantic horn, you know. So that's and they love that idea. And I think another thing that John was kind of hinting at was that this sousaphone section, which, just for your listener to understand, the tuba is a little different looking than a sousaphone. The tuba is kind of sits on your lap and the bell points upward, whereas a sousaphone wraps around your body and you have the gigantic bell facing right out at the audience. But again, you heard me play some of that polka music where it's kind of this oscillation of two notes. It gets quite boring after a time. But, you know, the sousaphones, what made them really special, I think, or the rhinos, I should call them, is that they would actually play, you know, on Wisconsin and these other songs, and they'd actually play the main theme. They'd play the melody. So that was, of course, a hoot. Then when you hear essentially a bass line instrument all of a sudden get their hands on a melody and just squash it, you know, that's that's a lot of fun to listen to from an audience
perspective. Like a rhino would.
Exactly, exactly.
And some other tuba trivia I feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about was, John, you also taught me something as we were setting up this interview, that tuba almost became the official state instrument of Wisconsin.
Yes, that's right. I moved here in 1985, but in 1984, a state senator, I think his name was Carl Oddy, proposed that the tuba become the Wisconsin state instrument. My understanding is that eventually the bill sort of died before it got anywhere. And I also understand that a number of years later, somebody wanted to do the same thing with the accordion. And that also, I don't want to say that it failed. It just sort of never got off the ground. So to the best of my knowledge, there is no official Wisconsin state instrument. But who knows? The day may come where the beloved tuba may have that honor.
I think it's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much, John and Mike.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Renner, we are so glad you asked, why Wisconsin? That was Mike Forbes, professional tubist and low brass teacher at UW-La Crosse, and John Stevens, longtime tuba performer and composer and professor emeritus of music at UW-Madison. Our own Tim Peterson talked with them about the prominence and popularity of the tuba at UW and throughout Wisconsin. This conversation came to us from an audience question as part of the Why Wisconsin Project. And we invite you to submit all your curiosities. What do you want to know about where we live and what happens here, whether it has to do with our brass, our football team, or maybe a little more on the accordion as our state instrument? What do you say? Submit your question, and we might answer it in a future story. Just go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's WPR.org/Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, affordable housing for elderly family members. We'll talk to the resources director for the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability, who offers affordable solutions for families. Plus, who to tip, how much, and when. We'll examine the complex evolution of gratuity and help you figure out a fair value so you're not spending too much and you don't sound cheap either. That's tomorrow on Central Time from 3 until 6.